Good afternoon, everyone. Hope you enjoyed today's sessions. My name is Helen Christo. I'll be your moderator for today. I am an occupational health and infection control nurse at a long-term care facility in Whitby, Ontario, which is approximately 30 minutes east of Toronto. I'm going to introduce you to Christina McNamara. She's a nurse practitioner from Queen Elizabeth II Health Science Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. So I'm going to present on urinary tract infections in the older adult. I don't work in long-term care, but I consult to long-term care. My office happens to be in the Veterans Memorial Building, so I get lots of the nurses coming down to talk to me about urinary tract infections. I work in a memory clinic for the most part. I also teach for Athabasca University, so I've got my foot in a couple of camps. And I've been at this for 17 years as a nurse practitioner. Although it wasn't cool back when I was hired in 1997 to work as a nurse practitioner, so they called us expanded role nurses until the legislation came in Nova Scotia. So why now? Well, we just had a visit from the royals. And if you remember back, Prince Philip, and I don't know why, but there is big news about him at the Jubilee developing a UTI. And the headlines were interesting to me because they seemed to feel that Prince Philip was to miss the Jubilee weekend after being hospitalized with an infection. It was a UTI. But they seemed to blame it on being outside in hours in the boat in freezing rain. And that's what everybody talked about is, oh, he has this infection because he was out in the cold. And so that was one of the reasons why I kind of got into this presentation. I initially presented for Chica on this. I don't know if Dawn Can's here, but it's I'm blaming her for all this because I did a little presentation on UTIs, and it's kind of blown out of proportion over the last 2 years. And now I've done several presentations on UTIs, and here I am in front of you guys today, probably telling you things you know, but hopefully giving you some information on what you may not know. Why now? It's the most common infection in long-term care residents. It's a challenge to diagnose. It requires good intra-professional communication. And nurses play a key role in proper assessment and appropriate treatment. And superbugs, as you know, and you're well aware of. So drug-resistant superbugs kill as many people as the flu does each year in the U.S. Why now? Well, this is our medicine chest. And for me, prescribing antibiotics is a bit tricky for the older adults because of things I'm going to talk about like frailty, dementia, and delirium. But not only that, it's what you're facing every day is those superbugs. Here in Nova Scotia, we have to be careful of prescribing Cipro in the community. We're not to do that. And in fact, the pharmacist will call me and say, no Cipro in the community because it's resistant. We do it in the hospital quite a bit. So this is a comment from the CDC director, Dr. Tom Frieden, who says, if we're not careful, the medicine chest will be empty when we need infection-fighting drugs. So your antibiotic stewardship, which we do at the QE2. And interestingly, I presented this to a group of, not this same presentation, but to a group of primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, LPNs, RNs, and caregivers. And what they kind of said to me is, one of the physicians came up and said, antibiotic stewardship, can I use that word? I went, we've been doing that at the QE2 for some time, and Dawn Can would have a stroke if she heard you say that. Anyway, he's going to use the word. Luckily, I told him where to find it. Objectives. So to define urinary tract infection, and you know that, in terms related to UTI. So they're the common terms that we hear all the time to discuss atypical disease presentation, and that's kind of my specialty and what I see in my practice all the time. To review appropriate assessment of urinary tract infection in older adults, to review treatment options for older adults, and to evaluate a typical case presentation. If I run out of time, I may not do the case, but we'll try. So urinary tract infection, I'll let you read that. That's the definition. You're all aware of that. CleanCatcher and midstream is the standard, and it's accompanied by symptoms of UTI, so I'll explain symptoms shortly. Asymptomatic bacteria. I can never say that right, but you guys probably can. So high colonies of uropathogens, high colony count, 10 to the 5th CFUs, colony-forming units, and the presence of bacteria without symptoms. And this is what we see all the time, and this is often what nurses call us about. Pyuria is the presence of pus, so you know that, in the urine, and most common infection in the urinary tract system. Pyelonephritis is usually an infection in the kidneys. It can start in the kidneys, and it can be ascending urinary tract infection. Acute cystitis, urinary tract infection, a high colony count, greater than 10 to the 5th, and with symptoms. Relapse UTI, so I teach this to my students because a lot of the primary NPs out there have to differentiate between relapse and recurrent. So repeat urinary tract infection within 4 weeks, the same infecting organism, and recurrent UTI. So greater than 3 cultures confirmed UTIs in 1 year, 3 with the same or different organism, greater than 2 cultures confirmed UTIs in 6 months with the same or different organism. So symptoms. So I'm going to talk to you about the symptoms that you and I would feel if we had a UTI. So we'd feel dysuria, we'd feel frequency, urgency, nocturia, hematuria, pyrexia, so fever. Low back pain, suprapubic pain, urinary incontinence, and cloudy or foul-smelling urine, which we as nurses are very good at hunting down foul-smelling anything. Symptoms with a catheter, so no other cause of the infection. Rigors, new pain, and cloudy, foul-smelling urine. The challenge, so this is what I want to reinforce with you, is the challenge of older adults having UTIs. So elevated temperature, what is this in the older adult? So 1.1% above baseline. Febrile response can often be delayed. So lots of my patients are on Tylenol QID for osteoporosis pain. Their febrile response is going to be delayed if it actually happens. Elevated temp, nonspecific for UTIs. So here's a little bit of information about body temperature. It's lowest in pre-dawn hours at 36.1 or lower, and it rises to 37.4 or higher in the afternoon. Normal body temperature is maintained by the thermoregulatory mechanism that balances heat loss and heat production. This changes as you get older. As you know, your adipose tissue changes. It shifts from the extremities into the middle of the body. When I go into home, I do a lot of home visits, and I do it with this doctor. She's little, tiny, and skinny, and cold all the time. She's one of those ones always holding. I always think of Saturday Night Live because they make fun of these, holding the hot cup and wrapping her legs around twice and wearing sweaters. Oh, I'm so cold, I'm so cold. So I do home visits with Dr. Gordon. She knows I'm talking about her. And we go into these older people's homes, and it's cranked to 98. I mean, it's just, whew, I'm sweating, I wear layers, I start taking off my clothes. Janet's got her hot cup of coffee going, oh, it's lovely in here. I'm like, please stop that, don't encourage it. But, you know, the temperature is just, I don't know if you go and your parents, my parents are 70, my father's got the heat on and the fireplace going, and I'm sweating to death in there. So body temperature is important to consider. The challenge, one study found that less than 10% of all elevated temperatures in long-term care facilities were due to UTIs. So again, you know, to sort out. Poor Brian was killed off in Family Guy, for those who are fans. So there he is. Odor. So nurses are the worst. They call me and say, there's a smell. I can smell it. Wounds, same thing. They're, get your nose down there and smell. And nurses are always looking for odors. One study in a long-term care facility found that urine odor or absence of odor misled diagnosis of bacteria over one-third of all cases. Several studies have shown it is not a valid indicator of UTI, so sniffing around urine is not going to help you diagnose it. Improved toileting and hydration may improve this problem better than antibiotics. So I want to comment about dementia, and that's the patients I see. So for dementia, it's a game changer. It changes the look of UTIs in older adults. It changes the response, and it may change treatment depending on how far they are in terms of the illness. It's a key determinant of frailty, and I will talk to you about frailty. We have the guru of frailty here, Dr. Ken Rockwood and Dr. Chris McKnight. They both work on frailty, and there's lots of research published by them. People with dementia are vulnerable and often respond poorly to interventional treatment. So even if we start IV antibiotics on a severely demented patient, it may not treat it, and they may not respond well, and they often die. Dementia is an incurable and is associated with reduced life expectancy. So, for example, I have a lady who's in a fetal position. She has end-stage dementia, terminal, and I went to see her. The daughter wanted us to start IV antibiotics. So, you know, that's when you have to sit down and have a discussion about when you introduce antibiotics and when you don't. And end-of-life care is important, and sometimes something as simple as a UTI can be an opportunity for a good death for some of these patients, and that we don't treat it. In this lady, for example, we ended up talking to the daughter about end-of-life care. I work in another clinic called PATH, Palliative and Therapeutic Harmonization, and we do a lot of end-of-life care for demented patients, and we ended up not treating the UTI. And she had difficulty swallowing, so we couldn't treat with oral antibiotics, and she did pass away. And that was okay, and that was okay with the daughter once we explained what happens with dementia and trying to treat this. Just a little bit, and you may know this already, staging with dementia. So this is kind of a good cue for you. Mild dementia. So I have mild, moderate, severe, and very severe, which are the stages of dementia. This is Dr. Lori Mallory, who is one of the physicians I work with, talks about CURE and IRAN. I don't like mnemonics, but it works for some people, so I put it up here. So mild dementia, those people with mild dementia are not familiar with the current news and events. So when you talk to those people, you can say to them, can you tell me what's going on in the news? So they often say, oh, I watch the newspaper every day. I read the newspaper every day. I watch the news every night. I'm watching Steve Murphy out there. And then you ask them about the news. They say, oh, well, there's wars and violence and some killings. But they don't know the details around the current news. So usually those people have mild dementia. They also have trouble with instrumental activities of daily living. That's the IADLs that's there. Those are things like shopping and answering the phone and doing your finances, your banking. So they start to have trouble here. Moderately impaired people with dementia usually don't know the U.S. president, and they certainly don't know Harper. So oftentimes we use, showing my stripes. So moderately impaired people, we do ask, do they know the U.S. president? Because that's more current for them, and oftentimes they forget Harper. And they tend to rewear clothes. So when we're seeing these patients with dementia, and if you're in a long-term care facility, if you watch somebody go from mild to moderate, you'll see this. They're wearing the same clothes over and over again. Those with severe dementia don't know their relatives. So we often ask people, who's that person sitting next to you? Can you name your children? Who are your grandchildren? Oftentimes with severe dementia, they don't know their children, and they may or may not know their wife. I have one lady who called me yesterday to say, he locked me out and called 911 and said a stranger was trying to get into my bed. So he didn't recognize his wife. Activities of daily living are impaired then, so they need more help, more assistance, washing and grooming and doing those kind of things, getting dressed. And very severe is they don't remember anything. A lot of them are nonverbal and non-ambulatory. So what we tell people in the terminal stage of this disease, because dementia is a terminal disease, is that people take to bed, stop walking, stop talking, stop eating. Frailty is another game changer that we talk about quite a bit. So I want you to look at your patients who are in long-term care or who are older adults with the lens of frailty. So how do we define frailty? Well, there's multiple definitions. Rockwood and McKnight are defining it. And there's different terms that we see used in frailty. Is it weakness? Is it malnutrition or cachexia? Is it social isolation? Cognitive impairment, comorbidities, problems with function or mobility, age, other things. What we say at Capital Health and Center of Healthcare for the Elderly is it's a multiple things. It's as things add up, as people get more problems. So I see a 91-year-old who only has COPD, tends not to be too frail, it's cognitively well, compared to the 91-year-old who comes in who's demented, who has CHF, who has COPD, who has on and on and on, multiple medical problems. So Campbell diagnoses it, a condition or syndrome which results from a multi-system reduction in reserve. So we talk about reserve quite a bit. Capacity to extend, the extent that a number of pathophysiological symptoms are close to or past the threshold of clinical failure. So there's multiple things going on. It's just not one thing. So you and I have the reserve to have a UTI, get the antibiotics, and go back to work in 2 days, for example. You get pneumonia, you get treatment, and get over it. These patients who are frail, it tips the balance, it tips the scale for them, and they get extremely sick. So humans are a complex system. So we have this redundancy. So you're flying a plane, something goes wrong. There's multiple systems put in place to keep that plane in the air, like you and I. There's multiple things in place to keep us upright. So we get a UTI, we stay upright. The plane stays in the air because there's all these things put into place. So a little human error, not a big human error, but a little human error, is fixed by the plane and the systems in place. When complex systems are frail, so maybe it's an old plane, I'm not sure, they clinically fail with the highest order of function first. Ambulation. My patients who have a UTI take to bed. Divided attention, the use of tools, social graces. What does this mean? They fall. So we have somebody coming into our 9-lane service today who's had multiple falls. Nobody's quite sure why they're falling, but put money that we're going to do a urinalysis and a urine for culture because it's suspect that our patients who fall have a UTI or pneumonia. Divided attention, what does that mean? That means delirium, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about delirium. Use of tools, so a functional decline. These patients not only take to bed, they can't do things that they usually do every day. So they can't dress themselves. They can't do their grooming properly or their bathing. And their social graces, so they become incontinent and they have behavioral problems. So this you see in our demented patients is the behavioral problems. And mom's become agitated, and we're not sure why she's agitated. Well, she can't tell you that, oh, I have frequency and urgency, and I need to go to the washroom. Our patients can't tell you that. So this is a really good tool. It's available free if you want to assess frailty in your patients. It was developed by Rockwood and McKnight and others. It's on Dr. Rockwood's website if you ever want to download it. So it's there for you to download. And it goes from very fit to terminally ill. And the scores are kind of in between. There's a frailty index and a frailty scale. The scale actually can be measured. So here are the symptoms of UTI in older adults. They take to bed. They get a delirium. This is not my mom, allonword.ca is a delirium website that we've developed at the QE2. We had a delirium month. We weren't delirious, but... So we talked all about delirium all over the hospital because it's unrecognized by most healthcare professionals. So this is not my mom, allonword.ca is a great resource for you. And there's altered level of function, as I explained. These patients may not be able to voice their concerns. Delirium is a geriatric emergency. When I see a patient who's delirious out in the community, I admit them. that is a guaranteed admission to Nine Lane, which is our acute care geriatrics facility. It's life-threatening, particularly in older adults. If unrecognized, it can result from permanent disability or death. Health professionals do not recognize this and don't listen. So I hear the family members of my patients who come into emergency, and they come in and say, "This is not my mom. She was demented yesterday, sure, but today she's different." So it's an acute change, and mom is agitated or aggressive. So we need to listen to the caregivers. That's why collateral history is so important in geriatrics. And we go to the collateral a lot because you can't take a history from a patient who's dementing. And you always ask these patients or the family members, not the patients, the family members, is this a change? So the family members know that mom is demented and she's pleasant and she needs help doing this or that. But today she can't do anything. She can't figure out the water taps, and normally she could wash her face. So those little things are important for us to recognize and remember. This is the scale that we use, again, developed by Rockwood and McKnight, and what it is the balancing system of frail older adults. So you have health on one side and illness on the other. And this balance is tricky as you become frail. So when something as simple as a UTI pops in the illness side of this scale, it tips the balance, and these patients are in bed, and they're falling, and they're delirious. So it's a fine balance. So delirium, quickly, is a sensitive but nonspecific marker for illness in frail older adults. So we don't always know what causes the delirium. So sometimes we have delirium NYD. It occurs because staying alert, we're complex systems, and our highest order of function is to stay upright, and they fail on these older adults. Symptoms of delirium: inattention. So when I go in to see a patient who has delirium and I'm talking to them, I'll sometimes take my pen and tap it. And I'll say, "How are you today?" and just tap my pen, and they're gone. They just and totally don't know the conversation, don't know what I asked. For example, we use serial sevens. So they try to do serial sevens. Most of my delirious patients, you know, have difficulty counting backwards from 10. It's a good trick to use if you have delirious patients and you want to assess how they're improving, is those serial sevens, if you've ever seen that. Fluctuation, so good minutes, bad hours, good days, bad days. Psychomotor retardation, so some of them just sleep. I had a gentleman come in who has frontal temporal dementia. The caregivers, all they could tell us is he's sleeping, but he has blood in his urine. He had a catheter, so. Psychomotor agitation, these are the difficult patients to deal with. Poor one of the physicians we're dealing with, lovely man. I mean, he's just the nicest man in the world. And this patient is delirious upstairs, this Nine Lane. And every time he walks in, she just gives it to him. And the daughters are so embarrassed because she's never like this. But she tells him off in no, she's only 4'11". She's a tiny little lady, and she's just, poor Dr. Ginther is who it is. He says, "I don't know what I did. She's just so angry with me." And it's only him for some reason, so I don't know what it is. So I was at an interesting presentation that I'll share with you, and I talked to these ladies after, the Alberta Health Approach. So they had a really nice long-term care checklist, and I'm sure if you contacted them, you'd get that. They shared it with us in long-term care. And we're actually going to use it in the veterans, adapt it for our veterans. So they talk about typical symptoms of indwelling catheters, medical status, so not deteriorating rapidly, push fluids in 24 hours. Now, my delirious patients will not drink the fluids, so we end up bringing them in. Like I said, it's a geriatric emergency for us, and starting IVs. And align treatment with the goals of care. And again, like I said to you, those demented patients in the fetal position or terminally ill in the very severe stages of this disease, it's time to have a talk. I really liked their checklist because it provided additional information, like creatinine clearance. And I can't stress to you enough, creatinine clearance is so important for our patients. You lose creatinine clearance by 1 mil starting at the age of 40. So by the time my patients get to 80, they have a creatinine clearance of 30. And people are out there in the community saying, oh, sure, start them on Macrobid. It doesn't work for my patients. Can't start that drug unless the creatinine is above 40. And their allergies is important. So I thought that was a really good tool they used. Discussion with the team to ensure guidelines. So bugs and drugs are the anti-infective guidelines, which we tend to use. We have a hospital one, too, that's good. Practice points I thought they had were really good. More than three organisms, there's contamination. Consider hyperdermoclesis. So we do this up on the unit. We use hyperdermoclesis to try to improve fluid intake because their delirious patients pull out IVs. So if their fluid intake is less than a liter, we try to add that. And do not repeat the CNS after therapy, and you probably preach that. Urine for CNS is important, gold standard, to wait for the results, although in a delirious patient we tend not to, and antibiotic therapy or not. Prevention is important. Limit the use of catheters. So the first thing I do when I go up on a surgery floor for consult, take out the catheter. There's no need for these people to have catheters. Sometimes there's a reason to have a catheter, but for the most part, no. Ensure proper hydration, good perineal hygiene, and education. We need to educate nurses on, one, consider frailty, your demented patients, and not to go looking for antibiotics, which I find is common. So people call me and say, Tina, this guy's infected. He has a UTI, you can tell. And they haven't sent anything off, and they want an antibiotic quickly. And that's that's not the way we do things or should do things. Urine culture is the gold standard. The midstream for urinalysis or urine culture is what's recommended. Or if you can't get that, an in-and-out catheter. So in demented patients, we do in-and-outs. Asymptomatic bacteria is a benign condition, so we tend not to treat this, as you know. We do treat urinary tract infections of the lower or upper tract. That's an indicator for antibiotic therapy. So the anti-infective review panel 2010, my colleague said, you know, there's a new one. I'm like, I'll have to get the new one. We tend to use our pharmacist. I work with a PhD pharmacist, which is very helpful. Minimum criteria for antibiotic treatment. So this is from the anti-infective review panel. So acute dysuria alone, which doesn't happen in my patients, and fever. And again, that's a challenge in older adults. They don't have delirium here, which is concerning to me, so they should have included that. The minimum criteria for antibiotic treatment is there. Antibiotic therapy with a catheter, at least one of, again, fever is here, which is a challenge for my patients. New CVA tenderness, Rigor's, or new onset of delirium. So delirium is there, and that's important. Antibiotic therapy. So I'm not going to talk about all the antibiotics out there. Always consider the creatinine clearance. Macrobid, nitrofurantoin. Do not use if the renal function is under 40 mils. So this is under discussion. I find my pharmacist, PhD, says under 40 mils. Our pharmacist on the floor says, please don't use that at all. So they're not using it at all on the floors. Although you see ortho use it. I don't know what that means. 50% of ortho patients are also delirious. So you see catheters in orthopedics, you see delirious patients, and you see them using nitrofurantoin. Scepter DS, double strength is a problem for our patients. So it's a double hit to the kidneys and the brain. They become more confused, and their creatinine goes up. It could be temporary. It may not. So high rates of delirium with Scepter DS, single strength is fine. The other thing that I see is patients coming from emergency department with 3 days of antibiotics. That doesn't work in older adults. They need 7 to 10 days. So antibiotic therapy, E. coli is the most common for UTIs in older adults, 85 to 90%. There's an increasing resistance of UTI pathogens commonly used in antibiotics. In Nova Scotia, like I said, we don't do Cipro in the community, but we still do use it in the hospital. Common choices, amoxicillin or Keflex, as long as you don't have high resistance rates, which we don't here. I don't know about other provinces. I know the presentation that I went to from the crowd in Alberta had real trouble with resistance, and we're down to 2 antibiotics for this long-term care facility. Other than E. coli, you see staph for 5 to 15% of UTIs, Klebsiella, and Proteus mirabilis, and I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but some infection control person can tell me after. So these are kind of the bugs that we see. Consider other causes. So I thought this is just interesting for you. Atrophic vaginitis. So I get into geriatrics as a nurse practitioner, so I wouldn't have to look down there. I don't do PAPs. I don't have to. Most of my patients are over 70. But atrophic vaginitis is a problem. So there's a decrease in estrogen level after menopause. There's thinning, dryness, and inflammation. So we consider estrogen for treatment for these patients, and you do have to do an exam to sort that out. But you will talk to women who, the cohort that we're seeing now in their 80s tend not to talk about this. I'm sure the baby boomers who turned 65 in 2012, I'm going to be hearing about it, and they'll be coming with their Google searches to show me the problems that they're having. So estrogens, just out of interest, assist with the recurrence of lactobacilli and acts as a protective barrier. So that's kind of an interesting treatment that we could use rather than antibiotics. Cranberries, there's dispute about this. Some people say it's malarkey. We have one nursing home here in Dartmouth who's using Ultracran and using pills. Cranberry juice has been effective as a home remedy because it prevents E. coli bacteria from adhering to the uroepithelial cells, and thus mucosa lining of the urinary tract cannot support the uropathogen. And that's as recent as 2010. They're still writing that, so I have hope for cranberry juice. Acupuncture, which I thought was really interesting, as prophylaxis, and demonstrated that it could be worthwhile as an alternative to an antibiotic. Now, I would use this cautiously, and I'm not sure I would send my delirious patients for acupuncture, but I thought it would be interesting. So catheters, just a few comments on catheters. Not every patient needs a Foley. It's a last resort, although I can't get that through ortho's head. Those orthopods want to put a catheter in everybody and then just leave it, and they tend to forget about it. So when we get a consult up on the units for ortho, we go in and pull them out. One-third of catheters, so approximately one-third of catheters days are unnecessary, and many infections develop during the unnecessary days at the tail end of catheterization, so we should be pulling those out as quick as we can. Biofilm buildup, I don't need to tell you about biofilm. It's that slimy stuff at the end of the catheter. Not all slimy stuff is bacteria, but bacteria will build on the end of the catheter. Don't send the specimen from the bag. Still have nurses doing this. Change the catheters is the gold standard for a specimen. Catheters and a UTI, discontinuation of a Foley should occur as soon as the patient no longer meets the criteria. And some of our patients have urinary retention, men and women, and just need the catheter. We don't have anything to say about it. Need for continuation of a Foley should be evaluated on a daily basis, and that's in-hospital patients, not those who have to go home on a catheter. Avoid disconnecting the catheter and the drained tube. This helps prevent germs from getting into the catheter tube. Surgery floors, you go up there, disconnect it. Anyway, I've got on my bandwagon about that. Keep the bag lower than the bladder. So that is common sense. I know that. You know that. But, you know, you go up and you see this little old fellow carrying his catheter bag, and it's way up here, and you try to prevent that and encourage the nurses not to do that. Empty the bag regularly. The drainage spout should never touch anything while emptying the bag. I don't know how many washrooms and patient rooms I've gone into to see that. So I'm going to talk to you about a case. So this is Mrs. R. I don't know how many of you here are from Cape Breton, but she was Cape Bretoner. She insisted I call her Ma, which I call my own mother. So she had a past medical history of hyperthyroid disease, depression, osteoarthritis, and a right knee replacement. She was on Synthroid, citalopram, omeprazole, and some vitamins. When I saw her, she lived with her husband. She had five children. And Mim. And Mim was her daughter-in-law, who she considered one of her daughters and was the primary caregiver for her. She was an LPN in a nursing home back in her day. She had a grade 10 education. On September 20th, we diagnosed her with moderate stage Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, denial is not just another river in Egypt. The family just said, oh, no, Mom has memory problems. No big deal. It's not... Sure enough, she wasn't caring for herself properly. Nobody was checking up on her. Nobody was, so she was, instead of getting her in the mild stages of the disease where we could, you know, get treatment, and treatment early is important in this disease, she was moderate by the time we saw her. We started her on Reminil, 8 milligrams, which is one of the memory drugs. Her MMSE when we saw her was 16, so she was quite impaired. So that's one of the tools we use to assess memory. Her MoCA, the Montreal cognitive assessment, was 8 out of 30, so significantly impaired. And her FAB, which is the frontal assessment battery, was 5 out of 18. Her function, she was repetitive dressing, repetition in her conversation. So I don't know how many times I heard the story of Sonny. That's her son, that's what she called him, although he's 6'7", and Sonny really didn't fit. She called him Sonny, going to Alberta, and she told me the story every time I went and three times while I was there. By November, we increased her Reminil, and then I got a call from the family. Can you come see Mom at home? She's really worse. We don't know what's happening. So I did a home visit. We decreased the Reminil because sometimes medications can cause this, and usually we have a geriatric chant for delirium. Differential. Meds, endocrine, metabolic, electrolytes, a combination of above or something else. So the differential diagnosis for delirium is 4 pages. So that kind of gives us, you know, an idea of where to start, and we usually start with medications. So with her, we started with medications and thought the increase in the Reminil would start it. But while I was there, I did blood work, and they said the family doctor did a urinalysis. And I assumed a urine for culture, but I assumed incorrectly. By the weekend, she was much worse. We didn't have the results from the culture, and she ended up in Cobequid, which is another hospital in Sackville. And I called ahead and said, you know, we need to do a full delirium workup on her. The blood work's back. Her white count's up. I thought there was a urine for CNS on her. I don't have it. So they tend to do a dipstick and emerge, and she had a rip-roaring UTI. The urine in the catheter, which they did put in, was pretty well green and pussy. And also she was dehydrated, so she had a combination. Her diagnosis was delirium. So she came into hospital, and I'll just tell you a little bit about her story. She came into hospital, went to an acute care MTU, and fell out of bed and broke her hip. And so they put a sitter with her and still treating the UTI. They felt that she needed to go to a nursing home. They removed the sitter because the sitter wouldn't take, the nursing home wouldn't take her because she required a sitter. Because she had behavioral problems as a result of the UTI, and she fell out of bed and broke her wrist. They did move her into a long-term care facility where she died. All of it a result of a UTI and delirium. So it's a cautious tale. It's important to diagnose these quickly and treat them quickly in our frail older adults. Summary, remember atypical disease presentation in the elderly. So older adults don't present with the same symptoms you and I would. Always consider frailty. No symptoms, don't treat. Be knowledgeable about the causes of delirium and creatinine clearance. Cautious antibiotic use. So if you can wait the 24 hours and hydrate patients, However you can hydrate them. If you can do IVs, often it doesn't work for delirious patients. If you can do hyperdermoclesis, it's a great tool. The importance of prevention. And that's everything. If you have any questions.
I'm from Interior Health. And my biggest challenge, I'm an ICP in residential care, is the whole fax. So the fax gets written. It's sent to the physicians. The physicians respond because the physicians feel that there's a concern. It goes back, and before long, we are treating UTIs that really probably shouldn't be treated.
Yeah.
So my question to you is, what's your thought on that, and how can we stop that process? Because I've been in the middle of it. You know, you try to teach the staff, but what the feedback I get from the physician is, look at, they're faxing me. That, yeah, to me, tells me they're concerned.
So as a prescriber, it's a very difficult position to be in. Mm-hmm. For a prescriber, primary health physician in geriatrics, education is the key, like you said. It's people requesting antibiotics that we need to stop. And oftentimes it's nurses. It's families, too.
Yeah.
So we need to educate families. So I have families that say to me, Mom's urine is smelly. You got to treat it. I know she has a UTI. And they don't know, and I don't know, and she's poorly hydrated. So I think education is the key to teach the nurses, but also to teach families, because they request antibiotics too, thinking they're requesting the best thing for their parent or their aunt or whatever. So it's a difficult position to be in. I kind of stand hard on the rule that I'm not going to prescribe anything until I eyeball the patient, which is the luxury that I have doing home visits. Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Does anyone else have any questions? Just a quick one, or maybe a comment, is I get frustrated when I get a report that someone was prescribed antibiotics for a UTI, and the only symptom they had was that they were slamming doors, and it wasn't her usual norm to slam doors, and the nurse would write, called MD, got antibiotics for UTI. Where did that come from? I'm pretty sure a lot of you probably have experienced something similar. It's always about behaviors and nothing else. And we rolled out an educational package just to say, okay, sometimes they have behaviors, but it's got to be another symptom.
Exactly.
And it's still an ongoing struggle.
Yeah.
And the MD's not there to assess, so he's at the mercy of the nurse's
You need an
assessment.
NP.
We actually just got an NP, but she went off on mat leave, so we noticed a reduction of UTIs when she was here.
Yeah.
And then, or the antibiotics usage, and then when she went on mat leave, all of a sudden there was all these antibiotics being prescribed. So it makes a huge difference having a nurse practitioner in a facility.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. That was great.
Okay. And that's it.
Thank you, Tina. That was great. The next presenter, who doesn't really need an introduction, but I will introduce him anyways, is Mr. Jim Cotier. He's here to talk about why Granny gets sick, which is perfect for this venue. Thank you.
So was she just insinuating you're all grannies out there, and that's why this is good for this venue? And there's a second component to that, actually. We're talking about how we can utilize why granny gets sick when we're talking to our non-regulated healthcare providers. I think we're all probably in agreement. We're seeing more and more support people in our facilities. I didn't try to set up a definition of this as to what I'm referring to, but it's basically everyone who's not an RN or a licensed practical nurse or a registered practical nurse. It's your support workers, the people that help get your elderly out of bed, the people that help dress them, feed them. You can take, hopefully, this information back with you to your facility and utilize it, trying to emphasize the importance of a lot of what we do. I thank Paul Weber for running another Weber session here. It's unusual for me to do a Weber teleclass in front of people. Usually you're sitting in your office on the telephone staring at your screen, and it's nice to actually have breathing bodies out in front of me to do this. So every once in a while, cough and let me know that you're still there. I have my disclaimer slide up here. I do a lot of consulting work and speaking for the corporations that are listed here. They've had absolutely no influence on anything that I'm presenting in here at all. The objectives were listed in our handout here, and I've done this presentation before. Tina covered probably the most controversial part of what I'm going to talk about, which has been great. And as you notice, it took 45 minutes to give a good discussion to the urinary tract infection problem that we face. And I'm going to cover everything else in 45 minutes. So we're going to look at why Granny gets sick. It's what the first bullet boils down to, and recognize the stuff that our non-regulated healthcare providers are doing or could do to help protect our clients in our facilities. So I always start off with what is old, because I'm getting there. Old is when you're napping, but everybody's worried that you're dead. I don't have that problem because if I lie like this, I snore if I don't have my CPAP machine on. So there's never a fear that I'm not there. The other slide that I don't have in here is my definition of old is changing every birthday I have. And a lot of my references are going to be, I'm fortunate enough to still have my mother alive at 87 years of age and my mother-in-law alive at 89 years of age, but they fit many of the classifications that we've been doing here, especially with the discussion around dementia. Both of my parents, parent and mother-in-law, have some issues with dementia. So the first depressing part of this talk, I always find this actually fairly depressing to give because we are all going to age and we're all going to drift into aspects of this presentation and the UTI problem. So yes, not only do you forget where you left your keys, but your immune system tends to forget memory of infection or memory of immunizations. And we like to refer to this as immune senescence. Obviously, I did not drink enough wine last night because I could still say that. Or you have your dysregulation affecting the two aspects of our immunity. And this is not going to be an immunity presentation. That would be a day-long session. So you're going to get little high-level looks at some of this stuff. We have our cell-mediated immunity with our phagocytes and our T and B cells. And we have our humoral immunity where we produce our immunoglobulin and complement. And I'll talk about these very, very briefly. I love this slide. A B cell, I attack the invaders outside the cells. And your T cells, I attack the invaders inside the cells. Enough said. So your cell-mediated immunity decreases. So the cell-mediated immunity, the T and the B cells, as they decrease, you have a huge increase in vulnerability to your bacterial, viral, fungal pathogens. So you've got that direct correlation. They don't work as well. You're more susceptible to things. So I've done in red on the PowerPoint presentation here, those of you working from printouts online, if you don't have the red, basically anything that's been bulleted is what I think we need to address to our non-regulated healthcare providers. So because as I get old, my T and B cells aren't going to fight off infections as well, you don't want staff coming to work sick. Which, when you work with the huge bolus we have of part-time and casual staff, they don't get paid if they don't show up. So they will come to work sick. When you're working with full-time staff, it's not as bad because they can take a sick day and still receive their pay. This is one of the reasons we need to watch for tuberculosis if you have a resident in your facility that has a positive skin test. Because as your T and B cells start to drop off, there is a chance that they could reactivate the tuberculosis. You need to watch for those symptoms. But the symptoms, as described by Tina, for a lot of stuff here and a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about, always keep in mind at the back of your, always keep in mind tuberculosis. So weight loss. And I've got a slide coming up on weight loss, but if you start seeing weight loss, or if they have a chronic cough, which I'm going to talk about also. You're going to find in this presentation a lot of the stuff goes back and forth and everything is interrelated. The construction dust. We were having some conversations yesterday about Canada and the United States have some pretty good guidelines around construction dust so that we don't expose our residents to things like aspergillus that could be present in moldy areas or Legionella if we have stagnant water that's been lying around because they're more susceptible. But we were trying to discuss, do we have the same kind of recommendations happening in other parts of the world? And I'll have to check with some of the people that are here from other countries on around the construction dust. So your humoral immunity, your immune globulins, is also decreasing, so we don't respond as well to our immunizations. So we do give pneumococcal. We do do a booster after 5 years in everyone over 65 or underlying comorbidities. Our tetanus, diphtheria, hep B, influenza vaccines all give them some immune response, but not as good. And I'm always lecturing to my staff in my facility that If I take my son at 23 years of age as a nursing student, give him the flu shot, he probably gets antibodies from his wonderfully healthy immune system for about 6 months, and then it drops off. Myself at 56, I'll pretend I get it for about 5 months. My mom at 87, probably maybe 3 months, her immune response. They just don't have the same bang for the buck when you give them these kind of things. The immune globulins just don't show up. Hence, it's much more important for our staff to be immunized. Anybody not have a fight with this? Well, many of you, how many of you actually have it as a mandatory policy in your facilities for your staff to get the flu shot? Whoa. I'm a firm believer in A, immunizations, and B, masks for those that don't want to immunize to protect my clients. I could care less about them getting sick and staying at home. Staff don't come to work with influenza, but they do come to work in that 24-hour prodromal period spitting viruses on my clients and then go home after the 12-hour shift and phone in sick for the next one with influenza. Had that happen 2 years ago. There's a good study that I've listed here that influenza vaccination of staff does protect the elderly. Now, of course, we heard this morning that immunizations, and there was some argument coming from our expert from Hong Kong, but I still think it's the best we've got, unless we put masks on everybody walking around through flu season. This is a picture of me before my spa treatment and after. It's amazing what they can do nowadays. So skin, I'm going to move on now to the skin of the elderly and the problems that we have. So I've got a cross-section here of normal skin anatomy, which I remember studying somewhere way back, and the area that's going to come up here in the next slide that I'll highlight now is the basically this junction between the epidermis and the dermis. This starts to disappear and shrink. So both of these layers become very, very thin as we age. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in our skin. That's always fun when I look at the slide. I just know it's outside and it stays where it should. So we do have this problem of the top layer getting thin, the flattening of that dermal-epidermal junction, decreased elasticity. So actually, instead of looking like the one dog on the left, we can actually have our face lift and look like the dog on the right. That's been photoshopped. No animals were hurt in the production of this presentation. You get the decreased subcutaneous tissue, decreased vascularity, and Tina alluded to a lot of this also with our elderly as they become frail. This all leads to increased susceptibility to problems with the skin. I went in to see my mother-in-law. She had the patch on her arm where she had bumped something and a massive hematoma on her arm and taken off a chunk of skin. And the staff said, honest to goodness, it was nothing. And it was just amazing how it peels off of her. So skin damage can take many different forms. And I've divided it up here as to what we need to talk to our staff that are helping move our patients. So friction can just tear the skin. You do not move a client by pulling them. You are going to tear off chunks of skin. You have to use draw sheets. That's what that extra little piece of sheet is for, to help move the patient and reposition them. Pressure sores. It happens from immobility. We can't have granny sit for hours on end. We have to have regular repositioning of the resident. And this is the reason why. And a lot of this presentation is, your staff know this, but I always believe staff should be told the why. This is why we ask you to do this with this client and why we ask you to do this. You need to have cushions to protect those bony parts. And we're all pretty good at doing this. I think we're starting to try to cut down on it. Some of the stats aren't going to be that good when I get here, coming up here. Shear, where you actually get the two layers of skin grinding against each other when people slide down in a chair, we have to reposition everybody hourly. Especially as they lose their muscle mass, their muscle tone, and their ability to move themselves, we have to do that for them very, very carefully. There's huge amounts of other causes. We have to watch when the skin gets wet, so regular brief changes if our clients are using incontinence products. Incontinence by itself is going to lead to increased skin breakdown. We give them chemicals and drugs. They become malnourished, which I have slides on coming up here. Infections break down the skin. So there's all kinds of other things that maybe the non-regulated healthcare providers can't help with to a large degree, but we have to be aware of. Infected pressure ulcers, I never had a chance to talk to Tina about this in her practice, how much of this she actually sees. The numbers have varied as I've done this. This is the most recent. This is from a 2014 textbook that I reference at the end here. Up to 20% of our residents and up to 38% in acute care will develop some form of an infected pressure ulcer. We know who the susceptible patients are. The problem is a lot of the susceptibility is occurring as they break down. So again, we've got this interrelatedness of stuff going on. with the vascular insufficiency and the vasculitis and malignancies, diabetes, is all leading them to be much more susceptible. Infected pressure ulcers 101, you have your four stages, actually five. The inflammation and erythema, stage two, where you actually have some ulceration through the skin. Stage three, where you're starting to get it down through all the layers of the skin. Stage four, I didn't put pictures in. I would only do that if this was before lunch. And the unstageable, where you can't really tell what's down there because there's so much garbage sitting at the back of it. My pathologist actually took me in and let me look at a slice of tissue that they had prepared, taken through a decubitus ulcer. And you can see all the different layers. And it's amazing the amount of garbage that's in there. Fiber from the bed sheets, dead skin squames, talc, the oils that we put on the client's skin to try to keep it smooth so it doesn't have all of these problems. Absolutely amazing. But from my microbiology perspective, that's why we don't swab these. It's just going to grow a whole bunch of garbage from it. So I'll move on to malnutrition. These numbers appalled me, that up to 30 to 85% of residents may have some sign of malnutrition. However, I've also now got a mother-in-law in care, and she just doesn't want to eat. Just not her big thing right now. So here starts, again, more of the interrelatedness of what's going on. If you're not going to eat, you're going to have more of a decrease in your cell-mediated immunity. So not only is your immune system starting to give up on it anyways, if you're not going to eat, it just exacerbates that problem that we've got. So as soon as you become malnourished, you run into all kinds of other problems. You've got your delayed wound healing, so when the skin does tear by the sheer forces of someone moving a client inappropriately, it's going to take forever to heal. Decreased levels of consciousness. They're not awake long enough, or they're not aware enough to actually take in some nutrition, and that decline in the functional status that, again, Tina had been talking about. All kinds of causes for the malnutrition. My mother-in-law, a lot of it was the depression of actually going into a facility and losing her range of motion. She had a fall, hit her head, had a bit of a bleed, confined to a wheelchair. Bam, she's not eating. She came out of that with some medication and with some assistance from the family and the staff. Her dementia is there. There's an issue with malabsorption, and I'll be talking about the GI tract in some slides here. The change in smell and the change in their sense of taste. My mother lost her sense of taste years ago, which was an issue after my father passed, that she was eating bad food. Her sense of taste and sense of smell disappeared, and she couldn't figure out why she was having diarrhea all the time until I find that all of her bread and cheese was moldy. Because she couldn't smell that it was bad and was eating inappropriate things. So it's been very interesting putting presentations like this together, watching this occur in my elderly family members. And then the issues with problems with swallowing. Dysphagia, again, I'm not a nurse. I'm a lab technologist. So a lot of this, as I read it, I kept going, really? I didn't know this. 40 to 60% of residents in long-term care can experience some problems with swallowing. The recommendations are for our non-regulated healthcare providers is make sure that when you're feeding someone, you keep them upright, arms and legs supported, head midline, chin tucked slightly helps with aspiration prevention. It's not just a matter of shoveling food into someone and making sure it doesn't drip out the other end. We definitely need good assessment, and I think most of our facilities has someone around to do that, either a speech-language pathologist, you have a dietitian that can assist you with what a client is able to actually process. So we need to make sure that we have our modified diets and or consistencies. One of the funnier lines I saw, tragically, one of our speech-language pathologists, who is barely 50, 52 years of age, had a small stroke while at work, recognized it immediately, got appropriate care, has no deficits, but had to spend a week eating pureed food. And on Facebook, she was posting all of this so we could follow that she's done very well with it, but she said, never again will I tell a client with swallowing difficulties that pureed food's okay. She said it was disgusting, but it's necessary. And I don't know how to hide that. So if you have suggestions for each other, you can share that afterwards. And the problem with malnutrition is as the elderly lose weight, it becomes a very good predictor of mortality. So I've got the numbers listed here. So if you've lost 10% of your body mass in 6 months, that's not a good sign. You're on the way out. It's that drift. And it's probably something that Tina utilizes in that overall holistic look of, do we really want to treat this urinary tract infection? Granny's not doing well. Granny's not taking in nutrition. She's lost weight. She's got breakdown of her skin. It's the kind of picture that we all put together. So we do need to increase the calorie count, and you need to involve a dietitian on some of the issues that are happening here. We're not talking feeding tubes. That becomes a whole issue on itself. And the textbooks that I referred to on this didn't really like feeding tube because it's another portal of entry for all kinds of problems. So we have our protein drinks, the high caloric protein drinks, which my mother-in-law loves. It tastes like chocolate milk. She thinks it's great. She will actually sit there and work on one. And the assistance with the meals. The problem with my mother-in-law's facility, and we've addressed this, is they would come in with her little chocolate drink and give her a couple of sips and put it beside her and leave. She has no ability at all to give it to herself. So when my wife goes to visit her mom, she will make sure that this protein drink, I keep trying not to use the brand name, the Boost, the protein drink does not get, make sure that it all gets into her. And she will drink this consistently. So now this is part of each of her meals to make sure that she gets some form of calories in, plus she's getting some liquid in to help with the dehydration issues that we've seen. So you all depressed yet? So I'm very brave to take a drink of water before I talk about a decrease in our mucociliary transport that we see in the elderly. So the way I describe this to people is, if you remember from your anatomy and physiology, which was just last week for most of you, your upper respiratory tract has cilia, little hairs that are beating upwards, so that anything that gets down past your swallowing area before it gets to your lungs, you have these cilia that force it back up into the mucus, we clear it, and swallow it into our stomach. The elderly can't do that as they age. So they can't clear the secretions as well. They don't have that sense of needing to cough. When they do cough, it usually sounds like it's coming from their boots. You get the great rattly coughs and stuff like that, and they aspirate the respiratory flora. Yummy. So this, you know, microaspiration happens to all of us all the time, but we have an immune system that can handle this. People are worried about us having too clean of a society with our hand hygiene and all the stuff that we do around disinfection. You're constantly aspirating bacteria. Hence saying I was brave when I took a drink of water here. We all do that. Your body says, whoa, there's a pathogen here. It fights it off. You spike some immune globulin somewhere. They just can't clear the secretions well in the elderly. And on top of that, there's all these other problems that go on. They're going to have problems with the whole mechanism of getting stuff out of the mouth and into the stomach because of stroke, esophageal motility disorders where stuff comes back up from the stomach, the reflux, oral cancer. Our lungs lose that flexibility. They start to harden up a little bit. You get more gram-negative colonization of the mouth. Now, in my other talk on the physics of flying feces, especially in institutionalized adult, I would argue this is their own fecal flora through how badly we handle feces that I've been harping about all week here. But you've got all of these lower respiratory tract pathogens that can then get down in those nice, juicy, warm lung areas and cause a problem. You've also got our altered consciousness that we love to do to our elderly with some forms of sedation and stuff like that. And it's a fine balance that we have to do to keep granny safe, but at the same time make sure that they can still swallow and not aspirate. Previous alcoholism issues gives you problems with your respiratory tract, seizure disorders if you've had a stroke, if you've had general anesthesia. Again, you're forcing some flora down where it doesn't belong. Back to the immune globulin from slide 2, you don't produce as much IgA, which is a protective mechanism on your external surfaces, especially of the mucous membranes. So that's going to set you up again for this pathogen problem. It sounds like one of these perfect storms. You just get old, you're going to have problems. So what can we do to prevent a lot of this? Some of the obvious stuff, if somebody is receiving tube feedings, don't lie them flat afterwards because that stuff's going to come out of the stomach after it goes through the feeding tube into the stomach. You lie them flat, they microaspirate it down into the lungs. Have some care with dysphagia and have some form of a program in place to address this to try to make sure that they're not going to have problems with it. I had a reference here for the pneumococcal influenza vaccine also to help make sure that they don't get a upper respiratory viral infection that leads to the lower tract because it then also goes in and kills off some of these some of the cilia that they have in their upper respiratory tract. We've all experienced this. I've been with too many people this week that are suffering from the cold that lasts for another 3 weeks to 4 weeks of the dry cough, and it gets worse at night because you lost all your cilia. It denuded your upper respiratory tract, but you can clear your secretions. You have that cough to take care of it. Granny can't. So we want to make sure that they're not going to get a pneumococcal pneumonia or influenza pneumonia because it's going to lead to all these other problems that I talked around with the bacterial pathogens. So I've been lucky enough to take out my few slides that I have on urinary tract. I like the cartoon, though. I called the incontinence hotline, and they asked, hey, can you hold, please? I don't know why they have a guy there. Anyways, so Tina talked all about this. I've just got what makes us more susceptible to things. She did talk about the hormonal changes, that we have the problem with the vaginitis and the solution of using the estrogen. We have the problem of the perineum being so, or the anus being so close to the vagina and the urethra in females. In males, we like to let our prostate grow large and boggy. We get a urinary stasis because we can't empty the bladder fully, leading to a bacterial colonization that we've already talked about. We have a decrease in our prostatic secretions, which also have an immune globulin component to it. So when you lose that, you don't get that antibacterial activity that's going on and the protection of it. Also with the stasis, this is a slide here, you have your kidneys don't excrete acid or urea as well. And Proteus, it loves urea. It's actually one of the tests we use in the laboratory. It's actually Proteus mirabilis. It's funny when you said that because I said it out loud right away when I read it. Proteus mirabilis is a urea lover, and you tend to see that in a lot of elderly men with enlarged prostates because and bad kidneys because of this problem. They just love the urea that's there. Yep, we talked about that. You can't get them to drink. You use the hyperdermolysis if possible to get that up. There's one facility that I've actually, I think it's our sister facility. They keep little plastic cups of water at the nurse's station. And every time somebody walks past, hey, here's a cup of water for the ambulatory ones, they may or may not drink it. But it's something to do to try to increase that hydration. Other hints, a lot of this should be counterintuitive, but you should be wiping front to back if you're assisting an elderly female with some perineal care. Emptying the bladder after sexual intercourse, we may forget about. It's not that our residents are not having sex. We generally don't talk about it. The one textbook that's at the end here had a lovely chapter on assisting your residents with the difficulties that they may experience. I did not know you can have an orgasm with a catheter in place as a male. I didn't know that. Don't want to find out, to tell you the truth. But it's stuff that we don't talk about, but it's also very important that if they are going to have sex, it's a good idea to empty their bladder after to flush out the urethra. Let's move on to the GI, just to really build this. This, honest to goodness, this depresses me. I don't want to look forward to all of this. This is probably why I try to run and exercise. So your stomach stops producing as much acid as it should as we get older. Acid kills bugs that we swallow. You know, the infective dose for Salmonella is like 100,000 organisms. Shigella, 10 organisms, norovirus, 10 virus particles. But a lot of the stuff that you can take in will be killed by the stomach acid. So anything that is affecting the stomach acid, such as taking an antacid, which many of our elderly like to eat because they taste good or they think they're taking in their calcium, it's become a habit for them, can lead to a lot of problems. Plus, for those of us that are still not institutionalized, we can eat anything we want now and get rid of that gastric reflux with a pill. And now we're starting to see the C. difficile community acquired because we're not killing the bug when it gets to our stomach because it has no acid anymore so that we can eat our hot chicken wings. And it's been very interesting watching this supposition happen. I wonder if it's our acid suppression that's causing this problem with C. difficile. We've now got good evidence that it is. So our mucosal layer deteriorates not only in our lungs and the upper respiratory tract that I've talked about, but also in our gastrointestinal tract. Dehydration is an issue, that we're not flushing things through appropriately or having enough moisture present to produce mucus. I've been seeing a speech-language pathologist recently, and I was surprised to find your nose produces approximately a liter and a half of mucus a day that you swallow away. Hence, hydration. We really need to drink lots. And it's not because I'm getting old. Some trivia, the human gastrointestinal tract contains as much lymphoid tissue as the spleen, and approximately 80% of all your immunoglobulin-producing cells in the body are in the intestinal mucosa. So there's that big tie-in again. As it decreases, you're not going to produce as much immunoglobulin because you're old and you're susceptible to the infections again. Just a quick overview of some of the problems that we run into and how to identify what might be going on in your home. An abrupt onset diarrhea lasting 1 to 5 days is probably viral. I think we've all been through norovirus outbreaks. This year wasn't too bad, relatively speaking, in our facility. Community, it was out there. I saw a lot more staff phoning in sick with norovirus than I did see inside the facility. The viral one really kicks people on their butt, though, with the symptoms describing here. Yeah, and I've been there, done that a couple of times. Bacterial gastroenteritis, it's sort of a gradual onset, some malaise, some unwellness, odd episodes here or there. This is the one that can be scary because if you do start seeing overt blood, you know you've got a big problem going on if it's an 0157 that has sneaked in. The laboratory, one of our least favorite tests was stool for white blood cells because you actually had to swab the stool onto a slide, stain it, and then take a look at it. It was just gross to look at stool that way. Toxins. It's usually food poisoning, abrupt onset. I don't know if any of you have ever had the 30-minute cafeteria special where you eat something about 30 minutes later, both ends are firing stuff. Or as Robin Williams once said, the body goes, two exits, everybody out. So how can we prevent some of this stuff? Safe food handling. It's amazing what I see in our patients' rooms that are in complex continuing care that live with us. The hoarding of perishable foods. And you're going to have hoarders come into your facilities. You're going to have family bring in food for mom that should be kept refrigerated that you find in the bedside table 2 days later that they've been chewing on for a couple of days. And then there's that hand hygiene that I think we've had a lecture or two about in the past couple of days. And not only for the staff, but for the residents, making sure their hands are clean before they ingest the healthcare environment that they live in. So we like to give medications. Tina alluded to this in her case study there at the end. We give them medications that can decrease their level of consciousness. We can give them medications that cause urinary tract retention. We can give them H2 blockers to drop down that gastric acidity so that anything can sneak through into the gastrointestinal tract. We've got our corticosteroids that are going to screw up our immune function to a certain degree. And, oh, yeah, let's throw some antibiotics and kill off any flora that they actually do have down there. The inappropriate use of antibiotics for the UTI is scary to see. And I'm glad that we've had the presentation. The questions that were brought up is a huge, huge issue for us in non-acute care. Come off of that. We also have our invasive devices. That, again, was very nicely summarized for us. Don't use catheters unless it's a blockage that they actually need this to get rid of the urine. I don't know if many of you take clients in that have tracheostomies. I currently have two patients that have trachs in place. One is a chronic vent that we've had with us and will probably be with us for a while. We do have feeding tubes all over our facility in complex continuing care. In our geriatric mental health, you don't see much of this at all. We have our patients that are receiving dialysis. We have some PICC lines in my building, and I could not tell you how many. Do any of you do PICC line tracking of the number of PICC days in your long-term care facilities? I was quite surprised when I did it very primitively, which was through the laboratory who doesn't draw blood on somebody with a PICC. And we were averaging 700 PICC line days a month in my facility of 135 people, which I felt was really high for my patient population. Some of them, it's because of lack of venous access that we needed to get blood out of them. A lot of it is they've come from acute care and nobody's thought to pull it. So I'm hoping that someone down the road here, it'll probably come up on my list of things to do, is to try to get a good PICC line review, much like the UTI and having a Foley catheter in place. It needs to be assessed daily. Do you need this? And get it out if not. Because these things are just that little highway to hell, I guess would be a good song to play right now, but it's the highway to the heart, and you don't want to make them septic that way. I think with your non-regulated healthcare staff, they need a very clear understanding of that. That any kind of manipulation around a dressing site covering any kind of a tube or actually manipulating a tube can cause some trauma that will leave them and make them susceptible to an infection. There's a study that I just love out of Quebec around patient hand hygiene, Gagné, Journal of Hospital Infection 2010. I've talked about it in another Weber Teller class about the portal of entry, but all they did was wash the patient's hands two times a day and their central line infection rates dropped. Which means it's not so much how we manipulate it, but it's me playing with my PICC line dressing. God, this is itchy. Holy smokes, what do they got underneath there? Oh, look, nurse, could you put another bandage on this because I picked it off. I've colonized myself. I've put the organism and irritated it enough to make myself septic, not so much our staff. So it's an important understanding for the staff if they have to do anything around these kind of devices that these go right inside them. You know, it's obvious, but I really like emphasizing the obvious to everyone, physicians on down to housekeepers. The bathroom may have feces in it. You need to clean well because of that. Well, duh. But I'm always known for stating the obvious on these things. So, and the best way I still like to emphasize this is with that chain of infection. I know many people rolled their eyes. I stopped using the six-sided chain for a while, and I've gone back to it because it really does summarize all of that little perfect storm that has to happen to make someone sick. And it's the portal of entry, how the bug gets into the patient, that if you explain this well, it just puts that whole picture back together for your staff that are working with your clients that way. Tina talked on this. I can't emphasize this more, but making sure that your non-regulated staff will go to the nursing staff saying they're off, or the family has noticed that they're off. I know where my mother-in-law is. That may not get to the RN. It will get to the registered practical nurse, but it's generally the personal services worker that spends the most time with my mother-in-law. And I need to make sure in my own mind's eye that if Nana is off, that that information is going to get back to the person that can make sure something happens. We've talked about this. I've got 1.3 degrees over baseline. You had 1.1. We won't quibble over 0.2 of a degree. But you need to know the baseline on your clients. The other issue that I have with this, I was quite surprised to find patients on psychotropic medications and mental health tend to have a basal body temperature of about 35.5 in my mental health facility. So if they hit 37, they're burning up. So it's really good to know what your baseline is. Watch for hypothermia. Tina didn't mention that, but that is the other way that they go. They just can't mount that response at all. And don't go looking for a high white count. That's not necessarily going to be there. It can be, but in some cases, it's not going to show up that way. So we had a good talk there on dementia, on the frail elderly. And I had this realization with my mother-in-law. She doesn't know that you can get soap out of something by going like this to that box on the wall. She's looking for a bar of soap because for 80 years, how she washed her hands was with a bar of soap. So we put our clients into situations where it's easier for our housekeepers to fill it up. You're not supposed to have bar soap in a healthcare facility for the workers, but for the resident in their room, it may actually get them to wash their hands if they're capable of doing that. We have to remind and assist them. We're working at Providence Care on a admission form to assess our client's ability to actually do their own hand hygiene. And if it's not possible, I've developed a little sticker that just says help wanted with hand hygiene that we'll put at the door if it's a multi-bedded room and above the bed. So that staff going in will realize they need to help this person with their hand hygiene if they're dropping off a tray of food. My mother-in-law for the longest while was able to feed herself but was way beyond from her dementia and her frailty manipulating a hand sanitizer. There was no way she could do that. And one day that I put the hand sanitizer on her hand, she did one wipe and put her hands down and let it drip on the floor. So I did it for her. And I would hope if it's obvious now with her lack of mobility and stuff like this, this is back when she was still ambulatory, able to feed herself. She had no concept of washing her hands first. So we need to make sure that that is occurring. I was talking with my friend Amanda here earlier from our area, and she says, I emphasize that in all the facilities I look after as public health, have somebody stand outside the dining area, and after a while, everybody will be putting out their hands and rubbing it in if they are capable of doing that. If they're not, do it for them. I do this with my nursing students. It's funny watching the light come on with them at that level. We have a lot of students come through our facilities. The ongoing assessment of their hand hygiene capability should be in there with everything else that we do. Yeah, they're getting some skin breakdown, they've lost some weight, and they've lost the ability to wash their hands. That doesn't show up in any sheet I've ever seen. And it's so vitally important to help cut down because they've lost everything that I've just talked about to protect them from anything that they do ingest. So in summary. Yep, getting old's not for sissies. Have you ever said that to an elderly person that's whining at you? I do this. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to. I'm a lab tech, so I can get away with it. I didn't take all the how you should talk to a client. And it usually makes them laugh. I use this with my father for the longest while, with aches and pains and stuff like that, because he never believed I was sick. I actually self-healed a broken collarbone that was x-rayed years later for a chest x-ray before I started working somewhere. And to dad, everything was growing pains. And he wasn't even a nurse. He worked for the phone company and stuff, but if it wasn't arterial blood, you're not hurt bad. Get up, get going, sissy. So as he had his aches and pains, I kept throwing this out at him. It was quite funny. But it's true. This is going to be a nasty time as we progress and live longer to see all of this start showing up in ourselves. And I truly think that understanding why the elderly get sick will help us explain to our staff the importance of the stuff we're asking them to do. These are very susceptible people that we're working with that can still have good quality of life. It doesn't help if they start falling out of bed and breaking things. It doesn't help if their skin breaks down from pressure ulcers. It's not going to help if we're not feeding them appropriately, or when we feed them, they're actually aspirating the food, leading to a pneumonia. End of my presentation. I'll gladly take any questions from you.
Hello, I'm Dee Colburn. I'm from Pembroke, Ontario. I have a long-term care facility there. And I have just a question in regards to the flu vaccination that you were talking about, that you have a mandatory policy.
No, we don't.
You don't?
No.
Oh, okay.
Some of our long-term care facilities in Kingston do. That when you are hired, it is as you're signing the papers to work for this facility, it says you will get the, unless it's medically contraindicated, you will get a flu shot to work here.
Okay.
Sign here.
So do you know how they get around that? Just we've tried to do that, and we had an arbitration case with, we also have paramedics with the County of Renfrew, where it went to arbitration for the mandatory, and my employer lost. So we no longer do mandatory. So I was just wondering how I could present it to get that back.
What I would try to do is say from here on in, anyone hired will sign on to this. It's very hard to go retrospective to employees that you already have.
Yeah, and I guess our union is very strong in that. As I said, it was an arbitration case. So we haven't been able to do that in about 7-8 years.
The other thing to do is keep it optional, but give them the education and the statistics on the safety of the vaccine. Allison McGeer has a phenomenal presentation on how safe the vaccine is. Give them the information that by immunizing the healthcare worker, you protect the client that you're working with, because it's not as effective in the client. And you can give them my whole presentation gladly.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it is around the education. Tell them not to look at anything on the internet around vaccination. Mm-hmm. I just saw something.
I've tried. My rates used to be around the 94%. And now, since the H1N1, it's dropped. But, and plus the fact that we're not mandatory. We do have an exclusion policy, but that doesn't seem to work for me.
It's tough. Personally, one of my coworkers just managed to pick up H1N1 down in Cuba, who had always refused to get vaccination, and I could hardly wait for her to come back to work. I could hardly wait, and she came back to work, and I said, so are you going to get your flu shot next year? And she said, I'll be first in line. That's the declination should actually be, if you're not going to get the flu shot, we're going to give you influenza so you can experience it once.
Yeah, sure. That'd be perfect. Thank you.
I got to remember I'm live here.
Hi, Jim. It's Tina McNamara from Halifax.
Tina.
We could probably have a long talk over dysphagia someday. I tend not to consult our team because they want these patients to eat thickened liquids and fluids, and if you ever tried them, they're gross. These patients choke on their saliva. They swallow their saliva and still get aspiration pneumonia, and you can't change that no matter what kind of liquids you use or what you do. And quality of life to me in these patients. So a lot of my patients will refuse to take this food and stop eating because of it. And to me, the nutrition is more important than the aspiration in a lot of ways, because it's about quality of life at this point, not quantity of life in many of my patients. So the dysphagia team, they're a great team, and they certainly do help. But, you know, many of our families and our patients, if you sit down and have the talk with them, don't want that food. And they're going to aspirate anyway, and they need to be educated on that, that they're going to aspirate on their own saliva, and that's what happens. And, and so adding the thickened liquids and the G-tubes and J-tubes, as you commented, you know, in your excellent presentation, the G-tubes and J-tubes don't change the fact that they're going to aspirate, because, again, they're aspirating on their own saliva. It just causes more pain, and like you said, it's a way in. So that's just my comment.
No, I appreciate that. And doing this presentation, watching both my mother-in-law, who never wanted to end up like this verbally, she said to me, don't ever let me end up like this, let me die. We can't, really. We can't withhold treatment on her. We can't not feed her. They have to do the best that they can. It makes me look at my living will. I just found out I'm the executor of my brother. And I need to see what he's actually written down, because he's tried to get his language as strong as possible around some of this kind of stuff. My mom's in a very happy space. She's still able to eat. She doesn't aspirate that much. She ambulates, has no idea where she is or who she is or who we are. Well, she has a rough idea that I look vaguely familiar. A different setup. My mother-in-law is very, very bitter that it's catching up to her. But it's a huge issue that we don't discuss well, end of life, with people. Those of us that work in healthcare, I think, have a much better grip on we all eventually die. And let's do it with some dignity.
Thank you.
Yeah. Was there somebody else standing up? You have to come back up here, though. Sorry. Because on the recording, when people listen to this, all they hear is a little peep in the background.
So it's just about the vaccine. So I'm from BC.
Yeah.
We have an influenza control policy. We don't have mandatory vaccinations. We say you have the choice to either be vaccinated or wear the mask. So it's your choice. We implemented the policy in 2012. and the government pulled the employer's right to discipline staff, so our rates were horrible. We went through arbitration, and our medical chief medical health officer for Fraser Health, who I work with, Dr. Paul Van Binder, I think people may know him, when we went to arbitration, he presented a very strong case and won.
Mm-hmm.
Like, knocked their pants off. So, go to BC to find out what they did there. I mean, they've got it all documented. So, I don't know.
Yeah, the mandatory masking makes such perfect sense because of that prodromal period. And I don't care what you do to yourself. If you don't want to put this into your body, that's fine. But you cannot make my client sick. You will wear a mask in case you burst forth with influenza. I don't see how an arbitrator is going to rule against that. It's protecting our end product, which is our client. And I'm so glad to see this worked well in BC. I know there's some small areas in Ontario. Blue Water Health, I believe, had a policy that's worked very well for them. So how was did you see a decrease in outbreaks this year in British Columbia?
We had last year, in residential anyways, we had 41 outbreaks last year. It was a really, really bad season. And they implemented an order, Public Health Act order. And after that, we had a decrease. So last year it was 41, bad year. The year before we'd had 7 outbreaks. This year we've had, the season was particularly late. We had influenza last week in one of our care facilities. I think maybe 7 or 8 outbreaks. Yeah. Compared to 41 last year. So, and we included in our policy from the 1 year to the next visitors that had to be vaccinated or wear a mask.
Yep. Our 2 positive influenza A's this year, both families of their complex continuing care patients had refused vaccination for them. And on my floor, it was the non-vaccinated patients that were getting it. None of the staff got it. We didn't spread it, which I keep thanking the staff for making me look good and my peers. But 2 years ago with that bad season and our low vaccine uptake, I was trying to get everyone to wear a mask voluntarily.
Our vaccine, our first outbreak, our vaccine compliance was 98 and 94. So it was the bug.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, June. That was great. And thank you to both our presenters. They are wonderful and reminding us that getting old sucks. Just quickly, if you haven't heard my announcement, if you're going to the pier tonight, you need to be downstairs in the lobby by 6 or they're gone. As they say, you're on your own and you'd have to figure out how to get there yourself. They won't wait. And also, please fill out the best poster presentation and the oral presentation. And there's a ballot box. Or the boxes by the registration and all your evaluations as well. And tomorrow morning they start, the conference starts at 6:30 for breakfast and the AGM will commence at 7 a.m. in this room, actually 200E. Thank you. Yeah, you'd have to go to the lobby because what they're going to do is, oh yeah, good question. So they're first going to go to Prince George here. Or there, and then they're going to go to the Delta Barrington. Now, it looks like, yeah, because it says here they'll be picking us up at 6 p.m. at the Prince George, followed shortly by pickup at the Delta Barrington. Don't be late. We won't wait. Okay.
I'll tell you what, I can call and find out here in a second. Do you think the silver one is? I was going to say almost the opposite, so I'll just ask the other guy that brought it in here. Again, they just kind of left it here, and then I just kind of plugged everything in. So. Oh, actually, shoot.